Good evening. If you have a Bible with you, I ask you to turn to the book of 2 Kings. Book of 2 Kings, chapter 5. There's a story in that chapter, at least the first part of that story, that we'll be reading and discussing tonight after a few introductory comments. Once again, good to see everybody here. Whether it's your first time here or you're here every time, we are encouraged to worship God with you, and your presence is edifying to us. I will say that this lesson is something I've been more nervous about preaching than I usually am. There's a lot to talk about tonight, and this story is a story that I really love. Especially the more that I've studied it and preparing this lesson, I've just fallen in love with this story. And the book of Kings, 1 and 2 Kings, it's great stuff, a lot of good things to take from it. But sometimes it takes a little more focused attention, focused study, because it's maybe some things that we're not as familiar with. It's historical writing, which sometimes we can get bogged down in. But I ask for your help tonight to follow along closely, to use your Bible, maybe to jot notes down to look at later. If you're a Bible writing person, to write or circle things in your Bible. As we dig into God's word here in 2 Kings chapter 5 and try to get as much out of it as we can. Before we actually read that chapter, we would do well to recognize that 2 Kings 5 is one story in the midst of a lot of stories. Or maybe better said, it is one segment of a much larger story. And we would need to know, it would help us to know what has been happening in the larger story leading up to this point, so that we can fully understand what's happening here. Just as if you walked in and your family was watching a movie and they were in the middle of it, you would appreciate it and sometimes need them to pause and tell you what has happened so far so that you could fully understand what it is that you're about to see. So we want to do the same thing tonight, kind of leading our way up to 2 Kings chapter 5. If we just glanced at this story and the stories before it, we would notice that the main character in all these stories is Elisha. Elisha, the prophet, the man of God. But we would also notice that he's pretty new on the scene, that he kind of just popped up. In fact, he just took over as the official prophet or representative of God in Israel back in chapter 2 when he takes over for his master, his predecessor, Elijah. And the way that happens is significant. I want to look at that. And before we get into this part of the discussion, I apologize if I say Elijah when I mean Elisha, or Elisha when I mean Elijah. And even if I say everything exactly right, I know it's still confusing with the names being so similar. But in chapter 2, Elisha takes over for his master, Elijah. And the beginning of the chapter tells us that that is certain, that everyone knows that's going to happen, that Elijah is near the end, and not his death, but he's going to be taken up by God into heaven, no longer to work on the earth. And it's interesting, he travels with Elisha, Elisha's disciple following him, and they start in Jericho, then they go through Bethel, then to Gilgal, and each step of the way, Elijah tells his student, Elisha, look, I'm leaving, you know I'm leaving, you don't have to follow me anymore. But Elisha is determined to stay with him. And they come to Jericho, and they go to cross over the Jordan River, and Elijah uses his mantle to strike the water and part the water so they can cross over to the other side where Elijah will be taken up. But before he's taken up, he asks Elisha, he says, look, you've been following me, you haven't left me, what is it that you want from me? What can I do for you before I go? And Elisha there asks Elijah for a double portion of his spirit. He requests a double portion of his master's spirit, and Elijah tells him, well, if you see me taken up into heaven, then you will receive that. And he does. He witnesses Elijah being taken up into heaven. And all of a sudden, he's alone. He's by himself. His master is gone, and it's left up to him to be the prophet in Israel. And Elijah has left his mantle, his cloak. And so Elisha, in this instance, literally takes up the mantle of Elijah, goes back to the river to cross back over, and before he strikes the water to part it, there in verse 14 of 2 Kings 2, he asks a very interesting question. Elisha asks, before he strikes the water, where is Jehovah, the God of Elijah? Where is Jehovah, the God of Elijah? Seems like an interesting question, an odd question for a prophet like Elisha to ask. But the point is that even Elisha himself maybe had some doubts or was wondering if Jehovah would be with him just as much as he was with his predecessor, Elijah. You know, Elijah had done all this great work with God's help. Would God now be with him now that Elijah has gone? Well, the answer, at least in that instance, is answered, or the question is answered when he strikes the water and it parts before him. But even when he comes into town, back into Jericho, the sons of the prophets, who are kind of like prophet groupies in the story, or maybe disciples of the prophet, they recognize that the spirit of Elijah is now on Elisha. But even more than that, the story goes on to kind of show that Elisha is now the new prophet. He actually retraces the very steps, starting there in Jericho, then back to Bethel, then back to Gilgal, each step of the way performing miracles that show that he now has the power of God. In fact, especially in chapter 4, we see Elisha perform these miracles that are extremely reminiscent of the same miracles that Elijah performed when he was working earlier. And so the point of the story, as 2 Kings opens up, is that, yes, there's a new face. There's a new man of God. There's a new prophet working in Israel. But Jehovah is still just as present and just as active as he always has been. And if we zoom out even farther and look at 1 and 2 Kings together, really that's just one book that in modern times we have split up into two parts for convenience sake. If we zoom out even farther, this idea that God is present or God is active in Israel, especially that God is active through his prophet, that is largely in question in these two books. Which again seems strange, because if these books are about the nation of Israel, the Israelites, the people of God, the children of Abraham, how could that ever be in question? That God is present, that God is active, and that he is working through his prophet. Well, that's kind of the point. 1 and 2 Kings shows us how far Israel had fallen to the point where it was debated. It was unknown to most people whether or not Jehovah was actually God and whether or not Jehovah was actually working in the nation anymore. We see this maybe most famously in 1 Kings chapter 18 when Elijah has this famous contest with the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. And to introduce that contest, he asks this question. If Jehovah is God, serve him. And if Baal is God, serve him. He says, how long will you go back and forth? Figure out which one is the real God and serve that God. Again, same question. Is Jehovah really God in Israel? Well, again, in that story, Elijah proves it. The prophets of Baal obviously failed to call on him to bring fire down from heaven. But fire comes down from Jehovah, consumes the sacrifice, to show in the words of Elijah that Jehovah is the God in Israel and that Elijah is his servant. But unfortunately, that contest doesn't answer it for everybody. The people still don't really get it, and that question keeps on coming up as the text moves forward. In 1 Kings chapter 22, King Ahab and King Jehoshaphat are going to war together. And Ahab has all his yes men there telling him how they're going to win the battle and how great he is and how victorious they will be. And Jehoshaphat kind of looks around. He's more of a righteous king. And he looks around and says, wait a second. Is there a prophet of Jehovah around here anywhere? And Ahab reluctantly calls on one. And then Jehoshaphat has to ask the same question later in 2 Kings chapter 3 with Ahab's son, Jehoram. They're going to war together. And Jehoram has to ask again, is there a prophet of Jehovah here in Israel? But maybe most striking is in 2 Kings 1, when Ahab's son Ahaziah is now king in his place and is injured. And because he's injured and at the point of death, he sends messengers to this false god in Philistia, Beelzebub, to see if he's going to get better or not. And Elijah meets him on the way, meets these messengers on the way. And this is the question that Elijah has for Ahaziah, which is repeated three times in that short chapter. The question is this. Is there no God in Israel? that you go to inquire of Beelzebub? Is it because there is no God in Israel to inquire of him? Over and over again, we see the same question being asked by the people in Israel. In this time when Ahab and his sons have dragged the nation into spiritual and moral depravity, the question keeps coming up. Is there a God in this place? Is Jehovah really the God of Israel? And does Jehovah have a prophet here in Israel? And it's with that in mind, with that being the overriding question, that we read 2 Kings chapter 5 in the story of Elisha and Naaman. With that question overhanging as the readers of these books, we then get to chapter 5. And read with me as we start in verse 1 of 2 Kings chapter 5 and ask this question. Is there really a God in Israel? And is there really a prophet of God in Israel? 2 Kings chapter 1, read with me, please. Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master and in high favor, because by him Jehovah had given victory to Syria. He was a mighty man of valor, but he was a leper. Now the Syrians, on one of their raids, had carried off a little girl from the land of Israel, and she worked in the service of Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "Would that my lord were with the prophet who is in Samaria. He would cure him of his leprosy." So Naaman went in and told his lord. Thus and so spoke the girl from the land of Israel. And the king of Syria said, "Go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So he went, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing, and he brought the letter to the king of Israel, which read, "When this letter reaches you, know that I have sent to you Naaman my servant, that you may cure him of his leprosy." And when the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes and said, "Am I God to kill and make alive, that this man sends word to me to cure a man of leprosy? Only consider and see how he is seeking a quarrel with me." But when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, he sent to the king, saying, "Why have you torn your clothes? Let him come now to me, that he may know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman came with his horses and chariots and stood at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh will be restored, and you shall be clean." But Naaman was very angry and went away, saying, "Behold, I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call upon the name of Jehovah his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. Are not the Abana and the Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?" So he turned and went away in a rage. But his servants came near and said to him, "My father, it is a great word the prophet has spoken to you. Will you not do it? Has he actually said to you, 'Wash and be clean'?" So he went down and dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God. And his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. Then he returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and he came and stood before him, and he said, "Behold, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. So accept now a present from your servant." But he said, "As Jehovah lives, before whom I stand, I will receive none." And he urged him to take it, but he refused. Then Naaman said, "If not, please let there be given to your servant 2 mules load of earth. For from now on, your servant will not offer burnt offering or sacrifice to any god but Jehovah." If the question hanging over us as readers of the king's story is there really a God in Israel? Is there really a prophet of Jehovah in Israel? Then the overwhelming answer from this story in chapter 5 is absolutely yes. There is a God in Israel, and there is a prophet of God in Israel. And it's interesting to note who knows that and who doesn't know that. Did you catch that? This little girl, this servant girl, taken captive by an enemy, by Syria. When she hears that her master has leprosy, she knows what the answer is. She knows that there's a prophet in Samaria, and she knows that he, by the power of God, can cure Naaman. On the other hand, we have the king of Israel, the leader of the northern 10 tribes, anointed by God to be a shepherd of his people. And when he learns that Naaman has leprosy, he completely freaks out and has no idea what to do. And more than that, this idea that there is a God in Israel really is the whole point of the story the text shows us. This is really the whole reason why Elisha performs the miracle in the first place. When Elisha sends word to the king, he says, "Send Naaman to me, and I'll take care of this so that," is the wording, right? "For this reason, so that he may know that there is a prophet in Israel." And we kind of read between the lines, and he's really saying, so that you, king, will know that there is a God, that there's a prophet in Israel. And that's the intended result, and that is the result that comes about. When Naaman is cleansed, that's exactly the lesson he gets out of this. He washes, he becomes clean, and he comes up saying, "There is no God in all the earth but in Israel." That's the point of all this. That's the point of this story. And that's the main point for us tonight. Because honestly, we live in a world much like the one we read about in 2 Kings chapter 5. We live in a world that is spiritually and morally depraved. Well, it's very easy to look around, watch the news for 15 minutes, talk to the people that you work with, go out into some public place and look around and listen to what people are talking about. And you come away from that asking yourself, is there a God in this place? Is there really a God in this land? And are there any prophets of God here? Are there any representatives, any people of God around? There's so much sin and evil in the world. So many people out there that don't know the answer to that question. And unfortunately, the people like us, the people that should know that the clearest, often don't know that. Or at least keep silent about that fact. But we see from Naaman's reaction, again, that there is a God in Israel, but Naaman goes a step farther. Naaman's response shows us that if God truly is God, if Jehovah really is God in Israel, then that changes the way we live our life. Naaman at first proclaims that truth. There is no God in all the earth but in Israel. But the next thing he says is that because that's true, he says, "I will no longer offer any burnt offering. I will offer no sacrifice to any God but Jehovah." Because if Jehovah truly is God, if we truly believe that, if we truly proclaim that, then that changes the way we live. And there's two ways in particular from this story that I want to pull out for us, two ways that should change our lives. And the first thing is that if Jehovah really is God, then we ought to recommend him to others. If Jehovah is God, then we should recommend him to a lost and dying world. We pointed out the little girl at the beginning of the story. And really, the story is written in a way, it's told to us in a way that kind of highlights the importance of her role. You notice the story opens up, like many stories in the Bible, introduces the kind of the main character, who he is, where he's from, and then there's a problem, right? Naaman's this great guy, he's from Syria, God's been with him, but he's a leper. Well, then immediately the solution begins to be introduced, and that comes about through, it says, a little girl who is taken captive by the Syrians. And then the solution is worked out at the end of the story. And once the solution is worked out, once he's cleansed of his leprosy, the text says that his flesh was restored like what? Like that of a little child. The same phrase of the person that introduced the solution in the first place. And really, this little girl holds an important role in the story because she's the one that knows the answer that no one else in the book of Kings knows. Everyone's been asking this whole time, is there a God in Israel? Is there a prophet in Israel? And this little girl proclaims the answer. And she recommends the answer to her master. She recognizes that he's in dire straits, and she knows what can help him. And so through her words, she advises him to seek out the help of the prophet in Israel. And because of that, she not only cures him of his leprosy and saves his physical life, but she causes him to be turned wholeheartedly to devotion to the Lord. And he comes to know Jehovah better because of her recommendation. But the other person in the story that knows the answer to this overriding question, obviously, is Elisha. And Elisha has the same goal in mind. And through his actions, through his miracle, again, his intention is so that Naaman will know about Jehovah, that he will know about there being a prophet and there being a God in Israel. So the lesson for us is to do the same thing as these two characters. Our job is to recommend Jehovah to a world that desperately needs him. And there's kind of two ways that we do that. And it seems to me that the little girl and Elisha kind of show us those two ways. The first is through our words in recommending God. You notice that just a simple statement from the servant girl to her master dying really is the same thing that we can do to the people we know. People all around us are dying of spiritual leprosy. Their lives are full of sin and their souls are lost. And we know the solution. And I know we know the solution because we come here 3 times a week, we sing songs about it, we pray prayers about it, we hear sermons about it, we tell each other there is no salvation out there except in Jesus. Jesus is the way, the truth, the life. And we're really comfortable telling each other that when we get in a setting like this. But yeah, I know in my experience, being out in a place surrounded by people that don't know Jehovah, I too often keep silent about that truth. We need to take these same words of this little girl to the people around us. And with our words, say to these people, if only you knew the God of the Bible, your soul could be saved. Would that you were with the prophet, the Messiah, Jesus of Nazareth, and in a relationship with him, you would have fulfillment in life, true fulfillment and hope of everlasting life. And you could finally live out the reason why you were created, to bring glory and honor to God through a life of faithfulness to him. We need to be telling people that and recommending to them the solution for their problems. But also, like Elisha, we need to, in our actions, lead people to God, to Jehovah. It's interesting, Elisha says that he's going to do this. He's going to fulfill this miracle. He's going to help Naaman for that reason, so that he can know about Jehovah. But really, Elisha then faces a dilemma, because Naaman is healed and is really thankful about that and has all these gifts to give to Elisha. Do you notice what he brought with him? All this silver, all this gold, all these changes of clothing. And he wants to bestow that upon Elisha when Elisha has cured him. But Elisha doesn't receive it, because the reason for doing what he did, the reason for curing and healing Naaman, was not for Elisha, but was to point Naaman to God. And the same thing should be true of our actions. We recognize, and it becomes pretty obvious if we're putting forth an effort to live like Christ, that we stand out in the world. Especially if we're making an effort, as we should be, to help people and be a force for good in people's lives. That stands out. People recognize that. But unfortunately, I know for me, the temptation is to try to use that for my own personal advantage, to try to gain some credibility, to further my own reputation or my own success, so that people will like me better or something. But again, the point of living like Christ in a dark world is so that other people will know God. And through our actions, we need to be leading people to Christ. And through our words, if Jehovah is God, then we need to recommend him. to the world around us. But the second and final thing tonight is that if Jehovah is God, then we ought to obey him. We ought to obey him. And we see that here in the story of Naaman. We've been talking a lot about how after Naaman was cleansed, he was very eager and very zealous to serve God. But we remember that that didn't come automatically to him. When he was first asked or first given the command about how to cure himself of leprosy, he wasn't all in on fulfilling that command, on obeying the command of Elisha. In fact, when he's told by Elisha's messenger what to do, to go wash in the Jordan seven times, he's very angry. He said he's in a rage. And there's kind of two reasons, primarily, it seems, that Naaman was so upset with the command he was given. The first is because it seems like he thought it was maybe too bland or too plain what Elijah had requested. Elisha, see, I told you I would do it. What Elisha had requested of him, he thought, you know, here's this famous guy. He's the prophet of Israel who can cure people of their diseases and perform these miracles. I can't wait. He's going to come out to me and show himself. I'm going to see this famous guy. He's going to, you know, wave his hands around. He's going to say these magic words and call in the name of Jehovah. And then through that, my leprosy will vanish before all of our eyes. It's going to be really dramatic, really exciting. When in reality, he doesn't even see Elisha. Elisha just sends one of his guys out to him and says, hey, this is what Elisha says. You just got to go bathe in the river. Naaman didn't appreciate that. But secondly, it seems like Naaman thought what he was being asked was maybe not pleasant enough or not convenient enough. He says that there's these rivers back in Damascus that are better, he says. And that probably means that they're clearer, cleaner, more pleasant to bathe in. But you can also imagine that Naaman kind of felt ripped off, right? Because he thinks, okay, I traveled all this way, probably, you know, maybe months of travel, maybe weeks, came all the way down here to Israel, and you're just asking me to do something that I could have very easily done back in my home. It would have been a lot more pleasant because the waters here are filthy or something. Naaman's upset with the command he's given. So for the second time in the story, Naaman has to take advice from the people that serve him. And his servants kind of knock some sense into him and say, look, Naaman, you're wanting some great, awesome thing to do. You would cooperate if it was something great and some great word, as they say. They say, how much more is this just a simple thing to do? Why would you not do something so easy? But really, I think what they're saying is that they're saying, this is awesome. This is really a great thing because it is so simple. They're saying, the fact that he told you something so simple and so easy, how awesome is that? That you can go and do this simple thing and receive deliverance, relief from this sin. So the lesson for us is to, like Naaman, eventually, we need to obey God and obey God's commands no matter what we think of those commands. Because often we're in the same boat as Naaman. We don't like the commands of God. We don't like what God has asked us to do. And I guess for all of us, there's different reasons for all that, but we're probably similar to Naaman in some respects. Or maybe we think what God has asked us to do is just kind of bland or boring or plain. And like Naaman, we're probably influenced by the religious world around us. And we see things that people do either in worship or in their claimed service to God or some other God that seems so grand and dramatic and awe-inspiring and world-changing. And they're on a large scale and they get a lot of people involved and people make movies about that kind of stuff. And it just seems so awesome from a world standpoint. And yet we look around at us, small little group of people, and we don't really do anything special from a world standpoint, and sometimes the singing's pretty good, sometimes it's kind of slow, we don't really know the songs, doesn't sound that great. We're not involved in, at least from a worldly standpoint, any large-scale, worldwide, life-changing organizations. Whatever it is, I'm kind of making stuff up, but you know what I mean, right? But sometimes we get turned off of the fact that what God has asked us to do is just maybe boring. And sometimes we're turned off because we think what God has asked us to do is just unpleasant or uncomfortable. Or maybe we think it's a waste of time. We don't get it. We say, really, God, you're asking me to do this? That's really not going to affect anything. I don't really think that reading my Bible every day is really going to make that much of a difference in my faith, right? I know I should probably talk to this person about God, but there's no way he's going to listen. That's just going to be a waste of time to try to tell this person about Jesus. And we kind of push back against the commands of God because they don't make sense to us, or we don't like them, or they're unpleasant, or whatever it is. But again, the lesson from Naaman is to obey God no matter what we think of his commands. Because really, again, like the servants told Naaman, how great is it that God has told us everything he expects from us? He's given us everything we need. That doesn't mean that it's always going to be easy or pleasant. Like we said, sometimes it's not easy. It's not pleasant. But in the end, what God has asked us to do is simple. And we're simply expected to receive what he said and obey it. And our deliverance will come. If Jehovah is God, we ought to obey him. And if Jehovah is God, we ought to recommend him to other people. You know, in Luke chapter 4, Jesus is preaching a sermon, probably in a setting very much like this. There's people gathered together. There's probably was some singing, and he read some scripture. He gave some comments about it in front of a crowd of people. And he talked about Naaman too, actually, in his sermon there in Luke chapter 4. And it's interesting because he's in Nazareth, and he's at a synagogue, and he's talking to people that were convinced that they were the people of God, that they were the chosen ones of God, that they had it made. But he tells them the story of Naaman to make this point. He says, you know, at the time of Naaman, there was all these people just like you in the nation of Israel that thought they were God's people. But yet none of those people in Israel were cleansed of their leprosy. None of the lepers in Israel were cleansed, but only one, and he was a pagan. He was a Gentile from Syria, and that's Naaman. And in that story, these people that Jesus is preaching to react in a way that I hope no one here reacts tonight. They took him out to the hill and tried to cast him off, to kill him. And there's a contrast there because Jesus' point is that Naaman was saved, not because of who he was, the nationality he was, the law he kept. The reason that Naaman was saved because he responded in simple faith and obedience. And these people in Nazareth, in spite of their claims to be the people of God, weren't. They didn't respond in simple faith and in simple obedience. The point of tonight's lesson is to remind ourselves, for all of us here to proclaim and to believe with all of our hearts that Jehovah is God. And if you're hearing that, then you need to believe that. And if you believe that, then you need to respond to that in simple faith and obedience, to obey him and to recommend him to the people of this world. And if you've never responded to him in any way before, then remember Naaman. Because Elisha, the man of God, told Naaman a simple thing. He said, wash and be clean. How much more will you listen tonight to the prophet that has told all of us to wash and be clean? I don't know what it is that you need to do tonight to make things right with God, to make Jehovah truly your God. But whatever it is that you need to do, I pray that you do that now as we stand and sing the song that's been picked out.